Hello, I'm Charles Mann, editor and host of the Power Sharing series, Professionals Sharing Knowledge. In this program of our Evenings with the Boston Computer Society, the speaker is Dr. Timothy Leary, who shares with the BCS members his vision of the computer used as a tool for tracking, measuring, and reflecting thoughts. BCS President Jonathan Rotenberg introduces Dr. Leary.
Our speaker this evening is just about one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life. His new autobiography, since we don't let people plug their products, is absolutely incredible, and I recommend it. He is described in the front jacket as part man, part myth, part knight, and part dragon. He's Dr. Timothy Leary, a major figure in our culture in the last 25 years. And he is here tonight to speak about his latest work in computer software, a product that he's developed called MindMirror, and some new things he's going to be telling you about tonight. And as I said, he's doing some incredible things. We learned tonight that he is about to star in a new MTV video with Grace Jones, among other things. So hopefully you have a chance to ask him about some of these neat projects tonight. Very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Timothy Leary.
Thank you. With the Red Sox in town, I didn't expect to see so many people. Anyway, maybe we can get any inviting updates. The underlying theme of what I have to say today has not changed from the earliest moments of my professional life. Many things have changed. Sometimes when I look at myself in front of the mirror these days, I look back at the different costumes and hairstyles that were popular over the years. I'm now the president of a software company. How 80s can you get? It's called Futique. That's the opposite of antique. Many things have changed, but one thing that has not changed is my basic posture, my basic life program, which can be summarized in five very American and very human words or letters: T-F-Y-Q-A. Think for yourself and question authority. No, when I say question authority, I don't mean necessarily picket or protest or run around screaming about how smart you are. I mean literally that question authority in the most respectful and thoughtful way. Ask those who are in authority, hey, well, what are you doing? Now, you will, as you well know, many authorities, perhaps most authorities, do not like to be questioned. So then it becomes our duty to insist on a dialogue. I think that this notion of thinking for yourself is an obligation. It's number one, it's the duty of an American to think for yourselves. It certainly is one thing that in my mind, I think in most of our minds, represents America, is this notion of a place, a new world, where people could, be independent and try something new. You're aware, as I am, that the world is in a pretty confused state today. There seems to be a return to barbarism and superstition and tribal passions and assassinations and very barbaric practices which we had thought were related to the past. And still, I know that most people on this planet are aware that there's one place where there's some opportunity, some encouragement, some empowerment to people to think for themselves. So it's like your basic red, white, and blue Yankee Doodle Dandy obligation to think for yourself. And to the extent that you don't think for yourself, and I don't think for myself, we're not copping out on our patriotic duty. How's that? Well, I'm a humanist and proud to be a humanist, and I think that it's our duties as human beings to think for ourselves. The scientist, the Linnaean biologist have defined our species as being Homo sapiens sapiens, meaning we're the organisms, we're the evolving creatures that we're not so big in the claw department or the fang department, and we certainly are dwarfed by dinosaurs, but sapiens sapiens, we're supposed to think for ourselves, and we've been endowed by DNA and life force, or God, or I don't care what you want to call her. We've been endowed with this incredible equipment to think for ourselves, a brain with 100 billion, to quote Carl Sagan, 100 billion neurons, each of which we're told has the thought processing, information processing capacities of an Apple computer. So there's a lot of equipment there. We also seem to be the only species, and again, I don't want to be anthropocentric here. God knows what goes on in those insect hives. Or we don't know. We're not sure what the dolphins are up to, but apparently we are the species that has been able to create and produce and manufacture artifacts to help us process information and to think more effectively and communicate more effectively. Now, when I say think for yourself, I don't mean think selfishly for yourself, nor do I mean insist on being idiosyncratic and never think like anybody else. I mean literally make your decisions, process thoughts independently, by all means listen to everybody else, and I think that those human beings that do catch on to the skill of thinking for themselves and who have generated or have earned the courage to think for themselves tend to be very thoughtful, and they're good listeners, and they're always trying to get more information, so that thinking for yourself does not mean any form of narcissism. And when I say question authority, it's an easy cop-out, you know, to blame the professor, the general, the minister, the pope for our problems, but the real authority that you have to question day and night, 24 hours a day, is, of course, yourself. The authority inside your own mind, because there's no question of it. The real force that enslaves us when we're enslaved, that tyrannizes us when we're tyrannized, who forces us into conformity and robot behavior and parrot thinking is our own mind. Now, before going on, it's my hope tonight to be able to encourage and empower us to think more effectively for ourselves. Before I get into the main body of my talk, I'd like to indulge on your patience for a minute to wallow in a bit of nostalgia. This is my hometown, at least on the North American continent. My foremothers and fathers came from Ireland to flee a very oppressive regime and settled in the Boston area. They, some of them migrated to the far, far out west of the time, getting as far away from the Brahmins of Boston as they could, being stopped in their emigration and navigation by an enormous geographical obstacle, the Connecticut River, and ended up in Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield, by the way, is a very, you know, was the the hippy-dippy L.A. of Massachusetts at one time. uh, I'm a born and bred Massachusetts person. The first high school I was expelled from was in Springfield, Massachusetts. The first college I was kicked out of was Holy Cross in Worcester. And the last university I was kicked out of was Harvard, so. Some of my mentors and idols in this wonderful adventure of thinking for yourself, of course, happened here within maybe 2 or 3 miles of where we are right now. The good old Boston Tea Party. That kind of summarized a lot of the things that I think are needed in America today. See, America was the first country that allowed for public intoxication. Think about it. In the past, the upper class could get as loaded and bloated as they wanted to in their palaces and estates, and the lower class, you know, but to stand up publicly and get drunk and dress in Indian costumes and throw the king's tea into the harbor. Well, I can relate to that. Nonviolent. Now, of course, the notion of participant democracy developed, of course, in Athens, but reemerged in a great renaissance in this area. The notion of the village, where we all get together and decide on the issues. We don't have to depend upon representative government. And I hope to get into the issue of the new political order, which will come from an electronic democracy in this country, in which we will all be able to participate in the electronic village, and we won't have to send people like Tip O'Neill to Washington or Senator Helms to Washington. I think the average intelligent American wouldn't send Tip O'Neill or Jesse Helms out to buy a bottle of wine. Or to the... I intend to be ecumenical and pluralistic in my satire tonight. I want to raise a lot of interesting issues, most of which I'm sure you're aware of, but any time I seem to be pushing one point of view as opposed to another in how computers can be popularized, I want to make this point very clear at the beginning. The wonderful thing about the adventure we're involved in, electronic literacy and the popularization of computerized thought process, it's a no-lose situation. Whether you're going to work with bureaucracies, or whether you're going to be with mainframes, or whether you're going to work with throwaway pocket software, the nice thing about it is that the electronic knowledge technology is the frontier of our species, Homo sapiens sapiens, and it's the future is just loaded with possibilities that should make us smarter, happier, and richer. The title of my little talk tonight is relevant now. It's The Popularization of Electronic Computing, or How to Make Millions and Millions of Dollars Helping People Think for Themselves. Now, I think that you can define a species or a society or an individual, the level of evolution this species or society or individual has reached, in terms of the technology that is used to process thought, that is to package thought, store thought, retrieve thought, communicate thought. And in the history of our species, you had obviously oral tradition. 25,000 years ago, thought was communicated and processed and packaged in terms of gestural and oral musculature. The storage of thought, of course, was the human mind, so that the old statesman, the old sage who had seen the generations come and go and seen the droughts and seen the invasions and the plagues, was the person who would transmit the thought. And of course, typically, I gather, in an oral society, there's not much encouragement for individual thinking. The great thing about the oral tradition is, of course, the oral tradition, and being Irish, I'm not one to knock it. The oral tradition, the oral technology is not a very effective way to communicate complex ideas. The oral tradition is wonderful for communicating emotions. And if you listen to the electronic preachers or to the politicians, you realize that they can really belt out those ancient syllables. And as they scare us and fill us with fear and dread and loathing, they are perhaps reactivating ancient midbrain circuits of our brain that that were very survivally necessary when we crouched together in caves and or out on the hunt, and the commanding voice of the leader was the survival issue. But the oral tradition is simply not very effective in dealing with a complicated electronic nuclear energy society. The oral tradition, of course, and the oral technology of communication is wonderful for those emotional moments in life of sharing intimacies and privacies and the little tones of voice and the murmurs and the little gestures and the little double nuances that we use in the tender moments, which will always be with us and which never can be duplicated or displaced by the printed word or by the hand-operated technology or even by electronic computers. So again, there's no either-or. And when I talk about more effective levels of thought, I'm in no way depreciating the wonders of gesture and the oral communication. Now, when our species started packaging thought in terms of Babylonian tiles or papyrus or illuminated manuscripts, a great step was taken. It allowed for telecommunications, for one thing. The political and the religious and the psychological dimensions of a society, it seems to me, are quite clearly determined by the technology used to process thought. Once we had this telecommunication technique of sending messages on tiles or on sheets, a larger social unit than the tribe was possible. Then we got into kingdoms and empires and feudal civilizations. Now, one thing that seems characteristic about feudal civilizations based upon hand-crafted computing is this. There's not much encouragement to individual thinking. The typical feudal computing setup was this. In every town, there was a big mainframe computer up there in the palace of the duke or the cardinal. And you had to be a hacker with security clearance to get access to it. They were called monks. And they knew the machine language, which was Latin. And there was not much encouragement for innovation and creative thought. Matter of fact, if you didn't copy it correctly, you could have your hand lopped off or worse. The feudal civilization, of course, is based upon the notion that God is in charge and there's a hierarchy of popes and cardinals and dukes and down till you get to the serfs. As I reread history from the vantage point of the 1980s, it seems to me that the control of knowledge technology is basically the history of our species. In the first chapter of the Bible, for example, is laid out quite clearly the attitude about thinking for yourself and thought technology. The way I recall it, there was a God, Jehovah, who said, I made the stars, and I made the planets, and I made the sky, and I made the earth, and I made the ground, and I made the water, and the creepy crawly things, and I made you, Adam, and put you in the ultimate destination resort, the Garden of Eden. Adam, you can do anything you want. I'm even going to take your rib and give you a servant called Eve. Go for it. You can do anything you want, except there are two food and drug regulations. Y'all see that tree over there? The fruit of that tree is a controlled substance. Y'all are forbidden to ingest or absorb in any way that fruit, because that is the tree of knowledge. Pretty straightforward, isn't it? And you know how the story goes. It's like an episode of Miami Vice. When Jehovah went back to headquarters, it was Eve who began thinking about it. And it was Eve that went to the tree of knowledge. It was Eve that took the fruit thereof. And it was Eve that ate of it and said to Adam, "Hey, you got to try this." Interesting that all the blame was laid on Eve. It's interesting, too, that the basis of the religions based upon this episode say that humanity was forever cursed because Eve and her poor Adam, if that meant for Eve, he'd be straight out still there in the Garden of Eden, I guess. Humanity is cursed because Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Now, I'm rather proud to be a human being, and I'm proud that I'm, according to the good book, descended from this woman who had the courage and the strength and the sagacity to start this long human process of thinking for herself. The feudal methodology for storing and transmitting thought was revised a bit in the year 1456 when Johann Gutenberg invented the printing press, which made possible the personal, home, inexpensive computer known as the book. Now, when Johann Gutenberg invented the printing press, I'm sure that top management at that time thought, wonderful. Wonderful. There are obviously four uses for the printing press. It's good for word processing. The clerks don't have to do this anymore. It's wonderful for telecommunications. We can send the papal bulls and the royal edicts out around the kingdom. It's wonderful for spreadsheets. We can keep the taxes and all that and like that. And it's good for recreation, too. The second book ever printed in the English language was How to Play Chess. And for those of you who don't know what chess is, that's an early form of Pac-Man. I'm sure that they did a marketing study at that time and came back and said, "Johann, forget it. There's no market out there for a home book because nobody can read and write." Now, I made the point that the knowledge technology used by a culture or a species or individual determines the philosophy, the psychology, the politics, and the economics. Within 20 or 30 years after Gutenberg invented the printing press, movable type, I love that word, movable type, there were hundreds and hundreds of printing presses springing up all over Europe. Every town, every city had its printing press, and the printing press became the center of the thought, of course, reading and writing literacy, the Protestant Reformation. Everyone was running around reading the Bible, writing their own Bibles, however kooky they were, at least they were thinking for themselves. Science, so-called Renaissance, democracy, all stem from this new popularization of reading and writing literacy made possible by the mechanical printing press. Now, everything we know in church today in human civilization and American democracy think can be traced back to this popularization of the wood pulp computer. Having said that, I have to point out some of the downside of the book literate culture. The book is basically a mass-produced thought processor. It comes cranking out of the printing presses, thousands, thousands, in the case of Norman Mailer and Judith Kranz, millions at a time. And there it is. In a sense, it's not very interactive. You know, when Moses came down from the mountain with his tablets, you know the wonderful Mel Brooks thing about, actually there are 15 commandments and he broke one of the tablets? Anyway, there are 10 commandments, don't you forget it. The printed book is like that too. Do we dare change a word of Norman Mailer? Or do we dare? There's a downside there. The printed book basically, it may encourage thinking, but not thinking for yourself. And certainly there's this caste industrial compartmentalization of the elite professionals who write, and reporters, and the law people, and the accounts over, then those who read and who have to. Many of the aspects of the industrial society, granted, it freed us from muscular labor, but in a sense, it didn't free our thinking as much as it could have. The virtuous human being in the industrial age was a person who was a productive and efficient cog in an assembly line factory culture. The good person was one who was prompt and reliable and uniform and dependable and efficient and productive. There's not much choice for innovation in an assembly line. You can say it's like a Cheech and Chong comedy. There's a, hey, let's paint this next one purple, or let's, hey, I want to go eat. You can't eat. Why not? I'm hungry. You can't eat until the whistle bell. Oh, yeah, right, yeah. There's simply not too much encouragement for innovation and creativity and individual thinking in a society. And by the way, I'm not being critical. I think each of these stages that we have gone through as a culture, as a species, we recapitulate as individuals. We depend on the oral tradition when we're babies, and then we learn how to hand stuff, and then we learn how to read and write. So that these are all necessary stages. And there are times when a book is wonderful. There's a time when a hand-operated and hand-drawn communication is wonderful. But the drawbacks to the industrial society, of course, are the horrid uniformity and mechanization. Computers have been around, electronic thought processes have been around for what, 40 or 50 years. And again, this extraordinary recapitulation of almost cultural embryology. You recall that when the machinery of transportation was developed over the last 300 or 400 years, the first thing you had were big steamboats. And the steamboat was run by a captain who was out there on the bridge. Or trains. You know, the one time was over 100 years ago, the train was the nervous system of the culture. And you built that train across the continent, and the New York to Haven Hartford Railroad, and the Boston and Albany, and Pennsylvania Railroad, and all that. You're too young to remember. When I was a kid growing up, you asked a boy, what do you want to be when you grow up? And half of them would say, an engineer. Burp, burp, burp. Because that was the hot thing to do. A lot of this changed, of course, in the 20s and 30s due to Henry Ford and his wild group of appliance makers who developed the home, inexpensive choo-choo train, the car, the auto. I love the word automobile. It means self-mover. And the implications of this, of taking the power and the energy of the mechanical Newtonian age and letting the working class have it, and letting boys and girls have it, and letting everyone has a car. The implications of this psychologically and culturally and spiritually, of course, are enormous, particularly politically, are enormous. Now, by the 40s and the 50s in the United States, the average middle class household had literally scores of machines, mechanical, Mr. Coffee Makers and heaters and bubblers and washers and dryers. And the point I'm making here is that there's an evolution, a historical progression here, that when a new technology developed, it takes the energy of a country or a big corporation to build a steam engine or build a train. But eventually, at least in a democracy, at least in the American democracy, it comes down to become portable, inexpensive. It becomes an appliance. Now, I love the word appliance. And one of the things I'm going to really stress tonight is that the future, big future, in electronic computing and digital thought processing is going to be seeing that a computer is basically an appliance. I love the word appliance because, you know, the Pentagon doesn't have an appliance and the KGB doesn't have an appliance. An appliance is something inexpensive, something that you have in the own home that's operated for your comfort or your improvement or your entertainment or your like that. It's a wonderful and basically it's American concept, this notion that the average working man and woman should be entitled to the fruits of the Industrial Revolution. Okay, you obviously know what I'm going to say at this point. The history of computing follows the same choo-choo train. The first computers, the big monster mainframes, and you had to be a captain, you know, like Mitch Kapoor or Watson, you know, IBM, the internal bureaucracy machine. In a very quick and painless way, the history of computing has kind of recapitulated the inevitable histories of the improvement of technology, simply because an individual cannot produce a technology. It requires a state, it requires a factory, it requires a bureaucracy to do it. But in a democracy, it's got to filter down to the individual because, remember, Homo sapiens sapiens, the key to the whole situation for the individual to think for his or herself. Now, I want to point out exactly what you're already thinking. See, in the Soviet Union, people don't have automobiles. The only reason you can get a car in the Soviet Union, I'm told, is if you're working for the party. In many, I'm sorry to say, most countries in the world today, the appliances and the automobiles and the auto stimulations and the auto muscle helpers that we take for granted here are not available to the individual because the point of these societies is not to encourage the individual to think for herself and to choose and to select and to basically treat life as a gourmet connoisseur. And people decry American consumerism, but I think it's incredibly good. I mean, the average yuppie today, people say the yuppie's apathetic. Apathetic? Hard work to be a yuppie. It's hard work. You have to choose the wine list, 39 wines. Yeah. You got a restaurant here. There are 32 kinds of special broths and herbs and sauces you have to go through. What kind of a Nautilus machine are you going to have? The yuppies. See, the yuppies are like aristocrats. I mean, they're gourmet connoisseurs. They expect the best of life. Hey, the easy apathetic thing is Big Mac, potatoes on the side, and Diet Coke, right? But to choose, to select, to discriminate our traditions that I think are great American contributions to the species. I made the point that electronic computing, which is basically electronic thought processing, I don't think that point is made clear enough. I have the distinct advantage in this conversation of knowing almost nothing about computers. Though it's easy to pop off. Frankly, I can't change a tire on my Apple. I can't open up the hood of my IBM PC. on the other hand, I've been driving cars for 50 years now, and I don't know how many cylinders my car has. I know it's the car I want. I've had it for 8 years, and it's exactly fits me fine and so forth. I've had many, many cars over the years, but I don't know much about computers, but I've been studying the computer culture for 5 years now, very intensively, and I've been a psychologist for about 40 years, so that I'm very, very interested and actively involved in thought processing and figuring out how to improve intelligence or expand consciousness so that maybe I can bring the freshness of ignorance to your group tonight in discussing the future of computer technology and computer culture. One of the genetic attributes of any species is the tendency to resist change. Now, I'm a born and bred change agent. I basically see myself as a cheerleader for change. But there's no pejorative stuff here. It takes for a species to evolve, there have to be some restless people that are being thrown out of this and thrown out of that and expel this and AWOL and so forth to make that contribution. But the survival of a species depends upon a modal herd hive tendency. But there is this tendency built into all of us, and particularly those of us that group together. You call it the dinosaur principle, that no group wants to let the game get any better than their handle on it. And again, this is not derogation. It keeps us, our species, moving. And as individuals, the momentum and the unchangeable aspect of our lives is necessary to keep us from being derailed and just flaking out all the time. But in the history of electronic thought processing, we see that there has been a resistance on the part of the mainframe people, against the minis, and then when somebody came to the big mini manufacturers, hey, we can get a home computer, they were saying, well, what would anyone want with a home computer? Where'd you keep it, in the garage? Obviously, a computer is an infernal business machine if you don't have a payroll, and if you don't have a big tax, what are you going to use a computer for? All this changed, of course, when the Henry Fords of our culture developed in 1976 the home appliance, the thought appliance. It was not in a manger. It was in a garage in Silicon Valley when St. Stephen the First and St. Stephen the Second, as legend has it, produced the personal, individual thought appliance. I thought it was wonderful that they called it an apple. I asked both of the St. Stephens whether they knew what they were doing, and they both took a Fifth Amendment on it. So, now, I'm sure most of you, perhaps all of you in this room, have gone through the agony that I've gone through many times a week when I say, why is it so slow? Why is it that we don't have computer software now that can attract an intelligent person, that can entrance a sophisticated person? Why don't we have computer software that is as interesting as a good movie or a good book? How come we're stuck with spreadsheets, and how come we're stuck with Dungeons and Dragons? I mean, why? What's wrong? We're waiting. There's obviously an enormous market for intelligent software and for software that pays respect for the high school mentality. How come? Because they've only been around for 10 years. They're 10 years old. Now, if you study, it's again the notion of ontology recapitulates phylogeny. The computer is 10 years old. Now, the first. There are the three R's of childhood computing. There's arithmetic, that's Lotus 1-2-3. And there's writing, that's WordStar. And there's recreation, that's Pong and Pac-Man. So let's not tear our hair about the fact that we have this incredible, actually everybody says, we know that electronic idea processing is going to change everything, but hey, when? Nothing's happening, you're just, yeah. Instead of Lotus 1, 2, 3, you got Symphony, right? And, hey, wait around, there's going to be a WordStar 79. Oh, yeah, really? But we're only 10 years old. No wonder. See, you can mark it almost precisely. The first recreational computers were Pong. Remember? Pong, Pong, Pong. That's like a little baby just watching a rattle go. Then we came Pac-Man. Is that suckling or what, you know? Then we grew up and we got Donkey Kong. Remember? Hey, we can jump around. Swing in the trees. Hey, great. I consider this 10th anniversary of the invention of the computer to be a wonderful, wonderful moment in evolution because the first erotic programs, have you heard about the leather goddesses of Phobos? Finally! Granted, it's schoolyard humor, but at least we're off the trees and into leather.
Theory continues.
Most sophisticated Americans think that we computer people are nerds. there's certainly no allegations of great sophistication, you know, attributed to. And it's true. I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley, and my wife is a very, very intelligent and a very, very elegant, sophisticated woman. She goes out with the wives of some of these hotshot designers and developers and millionaire Silicon, go-getters, and most of their wives say, "Hey, these guys are nerds." Hey. One-on-one, Dr. Bird, and Bird and Dr. J, or Dungeons and Dragons. I'm making fun of ourselves here because we are just beginning. And it's a wonderful position to be in, to be 10 years old with a tremendous future. Now here's how you're going to make millions of dollars a year. There is an immediate market for software that will attract the interest of high school or college educated person that reads magazines, if not a couple of books a month, who goes to movies, who's somewhat, you know, has some aspirations to intellectual sophistication or some modicum of ambition to think. Hey, these people are totally neglected, you know. Sure, that work. What are you gonna do at home? You know, Dungeons and Dragons. You know, how long can potions and swordplay attract the interest of intelligent, sophisticated Americans? The general theory is this, and here's the marketing situation. Anything that's now in the form of a woodpulp book. You know, look at the libraries, look at your own bookshelf, look at the airline terminal, you know, bookshelf. Anything you see in the form of a woodpulp book for which our friends the trees gave their lives can be put in the form of a screen. I know when you talk to literary people, they go ape when you say that. Oh, you can't put Shakespeare on a screen. Now listen, we're not going to burn your books. They make nice decorations in the library. They make good doorstops. They're wonderful. And we all like to curl up with them, sure. But when we say we can put any book on a screen, then it no longer becomes Moses and Norman Mailer telling us what we're going to read and think. You can interact. They become performance situations. We talk about a performance book. Now, I'm going to give you an example of what a performance book is. Take a book by Jerry Falwell. It's all about Christianity and Jesus Christ. Put it on a screen, and see, the great thing about computers is you digitize thought. You digitize letters. That's called word processing. So you can hit a thing and it changes all the L's to P's, or all the caps to like that. You put in Lotus 1-2-3, you put in all your numbers, and then the as-if function. Well, suppose we double the price, or suppose we cut expense. Vroom, all your figures change. Total different ball game. It's hypnotic, isn't it? You know, doing your income with Lotus 1-2-3. As if. But that's numbers and that's letters. But how about thoughts? Take Jerry Falwell's book about his Jesus Christ and change the word Jesus to, say, Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi Goldberg is the only Son of God. Whoopi Goldberg came down here and suffered for my sins. I've taken Whoopi Goldberg as my personal savior. Pretty subversive, huh? If you don't like that, change it. Right? Take it. Oil can Boyd. Digitizing, the ability to take any thought or any word or any graphic image or any sound and digitizing it, putting it on screen. Now we're not changing Beethoven's violins, that's fine. We're not changing anything. We're not going to burn books or burn violins. We're not going to burn oil paintings. Great. But we're not going to be intimidated by the masters of the past either. And you can make your own version. Gosh, with these new, I got an Atari $100 computer with a MIDI a little program hooked up to a little cheap little Kawai. And my 12-year-old son, he's got a 50-channel recording studio. And you can have Grace Jones, who knows, that can put your own voice in. You can boogie with Grace. All right, no. That's sound. Graphics, got these new VCRs, you know, where digitized graphics, you know. Where you can, there's Dan Rather, and you can stop, freeze frame it, and put a mustache on him. You know, you know. It's only electrons, baby. It's just clusters of electrons. We're not hurting anybody. But it's empowering the individual. It's encouraging the individual to, and it's nonviolent, doesn't hurt anything like that. We're just at this glorious threshold of, I don't know what you call it. Performance. This is no more. See, the notion of writer, reader, of musician and audience, of artist, you know, and patron, it all comes from feudalism or from industrial society where there was lawyers and doctors who you're defined as the profession that you have and all that. It's all over. You know, you say, sure, we're all going to be musicians. We're all going to be psychologists.
This is your editor speaking. As we change tape reels, Dr. Leary addresses a more pragmatic aspect of these changes he has been describing.
First market, let's get down to making money here. The first market is this enormous group, 80, 90, 100 million Americans who right now have no reason to buy a home computer. It's like buying a $200 or $300, $1,000 record player, great fidelity and sound, and there ain't no albums except Home Sweet Home or, you know, Onward Christian Soldiers. We got to give ourselves the software, the albums that will make these wonderful devices, appliances, really work for us. One final thing. How's the time here? I think I should probably stop and have questions, right? I've mentioned this reasonably intellectually ambitious audience of 100 million out there, starving. I want to tell you this. We are Homo sapiens, and like it or not, or ready or not, the average human being wants to be tickled and stimulated intellectually. We've been punished by it, and you know, we've been told you can't think for yourself. Hey, kid, put a propeller on your beanie and get out of here. Don't think for yourself. You know, who are you to think for yourself? You don't have a degree. In most countries of the world, the very implication that you're thinking for yourself is off to Siberia. In Russia, the worst crime, you know, is called hooliganism. What's a hooligan? It's an individual thinker. And then, even if you're encouraged to think, it's hard to think. You know, Rodin's statue of the thinker? Hard work, isn't it? Well, that's not true. Thinking is the easiest thing to do. I've got this product, Mind Mirror. It's a silly little thing, but it makes it fun to think. I tell you, the hottest, most interesting thing that people can do is mental intercourse, really. You give them some device, some appliance, some encouragement. But we're all scared. You know, hey, I'm hip. We can't have dinner and really get into serious thinking. You know, don't talk about politics, religion, or anything important. You know, well, these computers allow you. The computer's a wonderful device for communicating. In the old days, they said to Gutenberg, geez, don't let your kids read a book because they'll be at home and they'll ruin their eyes and they'll become socially alienated and they won't go out there and throw the spear. Well, you know that's not true. Boy, as soon as you start reading books, I'd run over to your house and, hey, what have you read? And it started, you know, it said 200 new Protestant religions. There's nothing that's exciting as using this incredible organ of pleasure, the human brain. The brain wants to be stimulated and giggled and tickled another sad thing about the human mind, like anything else, use it or lose it. Okay, I'll say one more thing about, lest I be imbalanced here. I've talked about the 100 million Americans that are desperate, just starved, because in an information society, if you don't give people information, and everyone's got to have a computer, you know, it's like water, it's like air, it's like food, shelter. We've got to have this information coming in. Even more important than the 100 million reasonably intelligent Americans are the billions of human beings that don't have access. You know, I'm talking, number one, about our own babies and children. There's a wonderful, incredible opportunity here to develop software using icons and mice, pointing gloves, that will allow a 3 or 4 year old pre-literate kid to, you know, sit down or with mom and dad and the older kids and start communicating. Because we can't, you know, the typical parent, I've got grandchildren who are teenagers, the typical parents are, well, I just can't talk to the kids. They come home from school and say, what happened at school? Hey, nothing, mom, nothing, dad. Because they don't talk in our adult language, but the cross-cultural, the cross-national, the cross-racial, the cross-continental, and the cross-age of adults and children of communicating with the language of electrons and icons and so forth is an even more exciting immediate promise for those of us that are in this thrilling thing called computing. Well, I'm going to stop now and invite your comments and your criticism and your ideas. If anyone asks you what we talked about tonight, I've tried to make two or three basic points. TFYQA, think for yourself and question authority. The computer, or the basic aspect of the computer, is a thought appliance for the individual. An appliance is something that is inexpensive and absolutely everywhere around the house. And the popularization. I am proud to call myself a pop psychologist. I'm a pop philosopher. I'm a pop computer person, because pop means population. The popularization, the egalitarianism of the electronic computer is, I think, a noble American and human goal for all of us. Thank you. Why don't we have a, I think this is for questions, isn't it? Does anyone have questions or, yeah. Want to come up, sir?
Well, I can do it from here. Could you elaborate on your mental intercourse product that you...
Well, I don't want to be so audacious and say I have a product. I think that all the software developed in the future should encourage this interplay. We have this one, the first product that my company put out is called Mind Mirror. It came out last July or August, sold 15,000 copies in the first couple of months out there. It's not the Gutenberg Bible, but it's a very respectable, innovative, it's the first program that was designed by the designer to be a thought processor. There are two aspects to Mind Mirror, or the digitizing of thoughts. Very simple. You take any lettered thought. Take the thought, I'll say, Christ. You know, millions, hundreds of millions of people have died over this concept of Christ. Have two Christians come and say, we want you to digitize your thoughts about Christ. It's a mind mirror. A mirror doesn't do anything. There's no little program in there that's smart. There's no artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence. That's an oxymoron, huh? Like military intelligence. What mind mirror does, it allows people to digitize their thoughts. Okay, here are two Christians. They're going to digitize the thoughts about Christ. And let's throw in Jehovah too, okay? Now, the word, okay, Joe, how do you see Christ? And what the program does is it gives you a series of calipers to measure this concept, this thought of Christ. We see thoughts, literal thoughts, like big boulders, heavy rocks, molecules of meaning that nobody really understands what's in them. And we're trying to see what the elements of the thought of Christ is. So the question that we pick out, the relevant things about Christ, is Christ kind? Oh yeah, very kind. Both people agree. Very kind. Is Christ well-educated? One would say, no. He was practically illiterate, fisherman. I said, well, of course he knew everything. Was Christ powerful? One would say, well, no, he was a man of the people. He was a fisherman. The other one say, powerful, he could change water to wine. He could walk in the water. They said, yeah. Is Christ Jewish? One said, well, yeah, sure. I say, no, why, Christ is a wasp. So suddenly you realize that two people who are Christians have two entirely different pictures of Christ. One thing, though, everyone agrees on Jehovah. Jehovah's not a guy you want to move next door. Jehovah's a Republican. No doubt about that. You wouldn't want to have him as a neighbor. He'd turn your wife to salt and cause a flood. Okay, you get the point that you can take any thought and digitize it. Now, by the way, it's not a test of right and wrong. If you don't like what you do, do it again. You can add dimensions. Is he Armenian? Is Christ gay? Is Christ... there's no end of the attributes that you can compare any two thoughts you have. It's also wonderful to talk about mental intercourse. We have an aspect in mind mirror called mind interplay, where up to four people or teams can compare thoughts. Very hot, smoky, steamy aspect of this is where you have a husband and wife come, and the husband measures his wife the way he sees her. Then he measures his ideal wife. And it says, now, Joe, you leave the room and let Mary come in. So Mary comes in, and she does Joe. Ha ha. And then she does her ideal husband. Then they both look at it. Well, you can hear them talking in the next room. You know, see, a mind mirror. See, the funny thing, Trip Hawkins of Electronic Arts was the first one I heard say this. The computer's basically a means of communication. Many people think, oh, the hackers are there and they're junk food and they don't talk to anyone and they can't get a date with girls, so that's what they're... That's not true at all. Computer is a wonderful device where you bounce your thoughts off it and it's just like a mirror, mind mirror. There's no right or wrong, there's no test. You can, if you don't like what you have there, change it. Well, I don't like the way the results come out. Well, okay, put on a different suit. It's like a mirror. It doesn't tell you what to do, it just shows what's there and how you can change it. Does that give you a... And Mind Mirror, by the way, is the first of a series of a line of products. We have souped up versions of Mind Mirror coming out in about 6 months. It's a line of products called Head Coach. by the way, the other aspect of Mind Mirror is the as-if function. That's the wonderful thing, as we point out, about word processing and number processing and thought processing. In the simulations mode, you could take Jesus Christ, my Jesus Christ, and there are 3,200 micro events, simulated events. You could choose to have, you could relive how Christ spent his 9 months in the womb, or how he made his trip through the thrill-packed fallopian tube, or what he did when he first met mom and dad, or how did Christ behave his first day in school, or then as you get up later, Christ can have a night in the town. There are 8 places Christ can go. He can go you know, the Republican cover. You can go to a suburban a house, you know, barbecue, or you can go to Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion, or you can go to a redneck bar. And Howard Christ, it's wonderful. The simulations aspect of thought processing, wonderful. The classic example, you take a person that wants, this is not therapy, we don't pretend it's therapy, but thinking more clearly should be therapeutic. You take a person who's very dissatisfied with themselves, say a depressed, shy, introverted, quiet, fearful person, and their ideal is charismatic and confident and popular and all that. Now, these are graphs on maps. So you can see, I'm here, shy, and I want to be up there, confident. So instead of having some neurosis or obsessive, anal, compulsive, this and that, you see exactly, you're in LA, you want to get to Boston. It becomes, how do you get from here to here? Now the simulations allow you to do that. So you can play the part, I'm poor, frightened Tim. And I'm going to try to act, simulate how I'd like to be. And so I'm at a party, and the host comes up, the little kid, and says, hey, I want your toy, wimp. Me, Rambo. See? How do you react? And he gives four possibilities. You bust him in the belt, or you charm him, or you run away. Now, all the momentum of a poor, shy Tim is going to say, oh, I hid. But and then as soon as he chooses it, a map comes up, and you see how close he came to Boston or to L.A. So you actually watch your thoughts plot step by step, event by event, till you're practicing how it is. And then if you can't get the score, if you can't possibly get the computer score on the map to move up to Boston, well, let's think about it and talk about it and try it again. So by God, at least you can get the screen thought up there. And once you can do that, maybe you can try it out in real life. So that's the digitizing of thoughts, the interplay of two, four people comparing their thoughts, and the simulations of trying out your thoughts and putting yourself in different shoes and being Nancy Reagan in a whorehouse or being Jesse Jackson at the Bankers Club or, you know. Is there any more? Yeah. Yes.
Tim, I've been a member of your audience twice, tonight for about an hour, and I'm an Irish-born person as you are. You're a humanist, I'm not, and I think our similarities end then. And there. The last time I was a member of your audience was quite a few years ago when you debated your friend Jerome Ledvin. Ask him how many people
and
here
were there.
Pardon me. That's all right. And you can have your time. And he left you with one famous word that he was criticized for, and that was bullshit. And you know, Tim, I wish you were the man you used to be. I'm going home and watch the Red Sox.
I'm an angels man myself.
The only I've seen you mine there in Leechmere, a local department store, on the Apple only. Is it available on other computers?
Mine there is now out on the IBM, Commodore, and Apple.
I see. And where can it be bought?
You know the software companies? There's very spotty sales on MindMirror. It's very heavy in the West Coast, and I thought it was heavy in New England. No sales at all in the Midwest. You can't win them all. Yes?
You ever met a fellow named Jeff Raskin who spoke here back in the spring? Very interesting guy. He's got a company called Information Appliance. You two ought to get together for lunch sometime. You might want to talk to Jonathan about him.
Where's his name?
I think he's in the Midwest.
Right. Well, could you get in touch with him or?
Jonathan will know who he is.
Okay, fine.
Several years ago, I saw you at the AHP conference and you showed a piece of software that MIT was working with that did impressions of people's thoughts. Are you still working on that?
You mean I demonstrated something? Well, wasn't that Mind Mirror? The prototype Mind Mirror, I think.
That was a prototype of this product?
Yeah.
I have, I guess, sort of a philosophical question. You were talking about the most exciting thing that you can, one of the most exciting things you can do in your life as using your mind and the mental experience, but then you also seem to place a strong emphasis on the marketing aspects and making lots of money. Is that philosophically for you, is that a technique to keep people's attention, or is that the second most exciting thing you do?
See, I don't know. That's a good question. It's about money and philosophy and money, and is that the aim? Is money the aim of? I think everyone. See, the interesting thing, the new philosophy for the 80s, 90s, and 21st century is the concept of the individual is free agent. You're responsible basically for yourself, and no one else can take care of you. You got to discipline yourself. You can't depend on Nancy Reagan to control your pleasure knobs anymore. You got to make these decisions for yourself. You've got to have your own personal mythology, and you got to have your own personal rate of evolution and growth. And everyone is different here. Tremendous responsibility to be a free agent. Tremendous because it's all performance. You can't count on the bureaucracy or the herd or the hive. You've got to keep changing and moving. Of course, you can lay back too. The question of money is something that everyone has to solve for themselves. Now, I have always been almost phobic about money. I've consistently in my life avoided making any money. And I would say that about 9 out of 10 months of my material life, except when I was in prison, I had to worry about the rent. And I consider this very rejuvenating. You can't lie around and get a fat butt if you're out there rustling up the rent every month. But it's hard on my wife. And I've got children in school and so forth. So I, just as a, like the seven labors of Hercules, I'm going to make some money just to prove I can do it. I think that there's a lot of cop-out of this. People that avoid sex, basically, they don't have self-confidence sexually. People that avoid competition. I'm really facing myself in the mirror, and I'm going to see if I can't be a successful entrepreneur. Now, we are working out in our, now we get into this, economics. I think that the basic post-war generation, the so-called baby boom generation, were trained by Dr. Spock to be life consumers, aristocrats, consider yourself entitled. That's the basic thing, Dr. Spock, to treat your kids as an individual. Every kid born in post-war America is an aristocrat, like the Roman, Civis Romanus Sum, I am an American, therefore I am an aristocrat. That was that whole notion of consumerism and hula hoops and Pepsi generation and all that. And the 60s, where that generation acted just like aristocratic kids of ours in Europe. Well known, the aristocratic kids in Europe, when they get to be teenagers, they have wild drug and sex things. They thumb their nose at the military because they hire the military. So the 60s were like a typical upper class aristocratic, anyway, I won't go on to the whole history of that generation. That generation did, in 1968, if Bobby Kennedy had not been assassinated, would have had a president who was absolutely a kid candidate. I remember that. And then in 1972, this generation did nominate and take over the Democratic Party, nominated the ultimate bubblehead, marshmallow brain hippie McGovern, remember? And then they did elect in 1976 a real kind of hippie candidate. Went around talking about human rights. Can you believe that? The concept that's developing in the baby boom generation, as they're now reaching 40. The oldest baby boomer is now 40. That means in the next 10 years, the baby boom generation is going to get to be between 30 and 50. 76 million baby boomers brought up by Dr. Spock to be connoisseurs of life. Life is a menu-generated universe that you're supposed to get the best of with responsibilities and so forth. The concept is free agent, and the concept of the economic situation we're developing is Futique is a team. There's no one hires anybody else. It's a team that, and we cluster together around projects. Like in the Mind Mirror project, there were four partners, the programmers and so forth, and we each divided up the responsibility and agreed on the share of profits. Nobody hired anybody else. Now, if you're going to play first base, you get a 15% and so much of the front money, and you're not playing first base. But if you can't come up with a code, then you have to hire another first baseman. It comes out of your part. Get it? So there's no penalty or firing and so forth. It's all kind of realistic. We got the Neuromancer Project, the mind movie, based upon it. How many of you have heard of William Gibson's Neuromancer? Can I have a show of hands? That's a hot science fiction book about a computer hacker. Won the Nebula, Hugo, and Philip Dick Awards. We're making a mind movie of it. And in that, there are 8 team players. And they all slice up responsibilities. There's no payroll. No one's giving orders to anyone else. It's like a team. Because the concept of work in the 21st century, there's no work. Work is something that people are forced to do economically, things that can be done better by a machine or a computer. Americans and 21st century people perform. You're free agents, you perform. And you collect in teams for a specific season or for a specific campaign. So that so when I say that I want to make a lot of money, I'm not talking, you know, me separately. My team's going to make a lot of money. We want to demonstrate. See, our main obligation to the rest of our species and to the rest of our society, if you believe in what you believe in, is to try to live your life as an example of that. And I've tried to live my life as an example of a rowdy, a publicly intoxicated person who thinks for himself and will take the penalties that go with it. And one of the models I'd like to lay down in the next 5 years is to show how I and my wife and a group of team players can really make a great contribution to this new aspect of our evolution, performance, literature, and books, and make a lot of money. So, I wish the same for you. Thank you.
Well, we're very honored not only to have Timothy Leary here tonight, but to have him here at the Boston Computer Society on the night of his 66th birthday. And if we're all ready out front,
sing a song.
Are we ready out front? On the night of his 66th birthday, this was rehearsed.
That was
go flawlessly.
That was birthday.
Okay, on the night of his 66th birthday, we could all join in a little round of happy birthday.
Day to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, dear. Happy birthday to you.